Welcome all. If I could ask anyone who can, if you can shift to video, that would be great. That way I can see as many people as possible, either way. So this week we have the Parsha of Tetzaveh. I think the general breakdown of Truma and Tetzaveh is that Truma deals with the building of the Mishkan, and Tetzaveh with the Big Day Kahuna, with the priestly garments. They certainly dominate at least the first half of our parsha. But before we get into the Big Day Kahuna, the priestly garments, there is a short section after which the parsha is named, Tetzaveh. How does the opening pasuk go? Ve'atah Tetzaveh Esbenei Yisrael. You, Moshe, Hashem talking to Moshe. As we know, Moshe's name is not mentioned in this week's parsha, that makes it unique from the time that he was born. But you, Moshe, shall command B'nai Yisrael, v'yikru elecha, and let them take to you shemen zayisach, pure oil, olive oil, kasis lama'or, for the lighting, laha'alos ner tamid. The first two psukim of our parsha deal with the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. And although this seems to us very wonderful, many Mefarshim actually find it quite troubling. How could they possibly be troubled by this? The reason is very simple. The parshas of Truma and Tetzaveh are building and making parshas. They're not mitzvah parshas. That means that every item within the Mishkan has a mitzvah that's associated with it. But that is not the topic of the parshas of Truma and Tetzaveh. You have the Mizbeach of the Ketores. But we don't talk about the mitzvah of Ketores now. It will come next week in Parshas Kisisa. You have the Shulchan for Lechem Haponim. But we don't talk about the mitzvah of Lechem Haponim now. That will come later in Parshas Emor. And Korbanos will come later in Chumash Vayikra. And therefore, the presence of the mitzvah of lighting the menorah is troubling because it's a mitzvah. What is a mitzvah doing in the building and making parshas? It should be left till later on. And in fact, just to make things worse, it is discussed later on. Twice, in fact, the mitzvah of lighting the menorah will also be discussed in the end of Parshas Emor. And again, in the beginning of Parshas Baalosecha. So it will be well taken care of in its place, but this does not seem to be the place. And that, in brief, is the question that bothers the Mefarshim. It didn't take long for Parshas Tetzaveh to cause trouble. As soon as it mentions the mitzvah of lighting the menorah, we're already up in arms. And a wonderful explanation of this matter is provided by the Baalei HaTosfos. We have collections of the comments of the Tosfos. Of course, they're famous for their comments on the Gemara, but they also have comments on the Chumash, collected in numerous places. The Das Zakeinim Mibalei HaTosfos says a fantastic thing. The definition of building. When is a building built? So, of course, don't ask the Kablan, otherwise you'll just be led to confusion. But when is the building built? When it's fit to enter. And when is a building fit to enter? If you have the walls and a roof, you have the basic building. Says the Tosfos, but if the building is a palace for the king, a palace is not fit for a king to enter unless it is illuminated. A king will not enter a dark abode. And therefore the components of what qualifies as the construction of a place, if it's a royal palace, includes not only walls and a roof, but also light. You're never fully built without a light if you're a palace. And therefore, to this end, Parshas Tetzaveh, which is still dealing with the building of the Mishkan, says, if you want to complete the building, be sure that there is light there. Fascinating comment. That is what menorah is doing in the beginning of Parshas Tetzaveh. I believe this may help us understand a problem that we might have in a very different context in Torah. Let us travel all the way back to Parshas Noach. And what do we know about the beginning of Noach, the making of the Teva, of Noah's Ark? Well, Noach was commanded to make a Sohar Lateva, Sohar Tase Lateva, to provide light for the Ark. Okay, how? Through what? As we know, Rashi famously quotes two possibilities from Chazal. One opinion is that it's a window. A window, after all, lets in light. The second opinion, and that's Rashi, Yesh Omrim Chalon, some say it's a window, but the other opinion is, V'yesh Omrim Even Tova Ami'ira Lahem, a luminous stone that would provide light. These are the well-known two explanations of Sohar, because Sohar just means light, wherever light comes from. And these two live side by side. How can we know which one of them is correct? We can't, and therefore we bring in both, and we're aware of both. The problem is, we should be able to know which one is correct. There shouldn't be two possibilities, for the following very simple reason. The mitzvahs regarding the making of the teva for Noah are divided into two groups. The first set of verses, which is Psukim Tesvav and Tetzayin, 15 and 16 there in Bereishis, they describe the physical construction of the teva. 300 amas long, 50 wide, 30 high, make a doorway, all of that. Then the second set of psukim from Yud Tes to Kaf Aleph 19 to 21 describe what you should bring in to the teva. You should bring in two of every animal. You should bring in food sufficient for them. So you have the building verses first, and then the contents of the teva second. And now, if we wish to know what that Sohar is it a window or is it a luminous stone? The way to find out should be quite simple. Find out which group of verses it's in. If it's among the construction verses, it's a window, because a window is construction. If it's included in the content verses, it's a stone, because a stone is something you bring in, just like you bring in food and the animals. Well, where is the mitzvah of Sohar Las Tase Lateva? It is in the beginning of verse 16, in the construction psukim. And that being the case, the matter should be resolved. If it's in the construction psukim, now we know. It's a matter of construction. It's the window. How can there be a dissenting opinion that it's a luminous stone? This was a question that I had for a number of years. I had not seen anyone raise this question until I came across a volume called Kishutei Torah, authored by someone called Rabbi Yaakov Koppel Reinitz, who I believe is quite a well-known entity here in the land of Israel. And I was happy to see that he raises the question. I was sad to see that he doesn't answer it. He asks, you should see from where it's in the construction psukim. Now you know it's a window. Perhaps we may suggest an answer based on the Baalei HaTosfos. Chazal tell us that the pasuk in Tehillim, Va'aniv rochastecha avo beisecha, I, in your great kindness, I come to your house. Well, what is Hashem's house? We, of course, understand it means the Beis HaMikdash, or a shul, perhaps. We say this pasuk on the way to shul. Lo and behold, the Medrash Rabbah in Parshas Noach says that this pasuk was originally said by Noach. Noach says to Hashem, Va'ani v'rov chastecha avo beisecha, you were kind to me and you brought me into your house. That is the teva. What we learn from this verse, as per Chazal, is that the teva was Hashem's house. And what does it mean that the teva was Hashem's house? It means that amongst every other life form, that dwelled within the Teva, the divine presence also dwelled within the Teva. And that makes the Teva Hashem's house. Likewise, the Medrash elsewhere adduces the verse in Tehillim, Shesulim Beveis Hashem, transplanted into the house of Hashem. Shesulim Beveis Hashem, says the Medrash, that is Noah's Ark. Noah and his family were transplanted into Hashem's house. This was the first human transplant successfully performed back in the day. But again, we see that the verse refers to the Teva as Beis Hashem, because the Shekhinah was there. And if the Shekhinah was there, have we not learned from the Baalei HaTosfos that a house for the Shekhinah is not considered built until it is illuminated, which means wherever the illumination came from, even if it wasn't an act of physical construction, it is the final act of construction. And therefore, you can't know from the fact that Sohar Tasel HaTeva is mentioned in the construction section, whether it's a window or a precious stone. Because even if it's a precious stone, adding light for the palace of the king, like the Mishkan itself, is part of the construction. So it's very interesting to see how the menorah in the beginning of our parsha, one could say, casts its light very far back, almost to the beginning of the Chumash, to help us out with the Rashi in Parshas Noach. The mitzvah of lighting the menorah. When does that take place? The second pasuk tells us, Me'erev HaBoker, the light goes from the night until the morning. This means that there are two parts to the menorah, as we know, to the menorah service. There is the hadlaka, or ha'ala'a, as it's called in the Torah, which took place in the evening. And there is the hatava, which is the cleaning out and preparing the following morning. Hadlaka in the evening, hatava in the morning, which means that the lighting of the menorah took place once every 24 hours, at the end of the day, just at the onset of evening. This is the opinion of almost all authorities, with the very notable exception of the Rambam. The Rambam said something which sent everyone reeling. In the Mishnah Torah, in Hilchos Tumidim Umusafim, the Rambam says that the morning service of Hatava also incorporates lighting the menorah. In his words, Hadlokas Haneros, Hi Hatavasam, the lighting in the morning, that is the Hatava. According to the Rambam, the menorah was lit twice every 24 hours, once in the beginning of the evening, once in the morning. That is a well-known position of the Rambam. There is a lot of discussion about the Rambam, but a most fascinating emanation of this Rambam actually directs us to no other place than to Hanukkah. One of the most famous questions regarding Hanukkah, and possibly one of the most famous questions in the entire Torah literature, is that of the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef, as we know, asks, Hanukkah is 8 days. We celebrate 8 days of miracles. The problem is, there weren't 8 days of miracles. There were only seven, because there was enough oil to last for 1 day. Which means if it lasted for 8 days, so 1 day is natural, there's 7 days of miracles. So why then is Hanukkah 8 days long? Many, many answers have been given to this question of the Beis Yosef. The question preceded the Beis Yosef, but it was made famous by him. He himself offers three interpretations of his own, three answers, but I'd like to focus on one of the early commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, and that is the Pri Chadash, Rabbi Chizkiah de Silva, one of the earliest commentators on the Shulchan Aruch. And the Pri Chadash says that in truth, the Beis Yosef is correct. There were only 7 days of miracle with the oil. And still, Hanukkah is 8 days long. Why? Because one of the 8 days of Hanukkah is not about the miracle with the oil. It's about the miracle with the war. The first day of Hanukkah celebrates the military victory. That gets a day in itself. Now there's 7 days left. That's the seven miracle days of the oil. In other words, according to the Pri Chodesh, war plus oil equals eight. It's a composite chag, marking and celebrating these two things. That is quite a statement from the Pri Chodesh. However, he doesn't stop there. Says the Pri Chodesh, not only do I suggest that this is correct, I can prove to you that it's correct. How are you going to prove it? Well, if you look in the Rambam, in the beginning of Hilchos Chanukah, he gives a brief introduction and a historical survey of the background to the Chanukah story. That's very interesting that he does that. The Rambam's job is to give halachic rulings, not to tell us the history of things. The Rambam doesn't give us the history behind any other of the Chagim. Why is Chanukah different? Well, as Meforshim point out, the Rambam writes in his introduction to the Mishneh Torah that if you know the Tanakh, if you have a Tanakh and my Sefer, you have everything you need to be a good functioning Jew. Well then, if you have the Tanakh and you read it, you will already know the background to every Chag, with one exception, because Chanukah happened after the Tanakh. And therefore, the Rambam, having pledged to give you everything you need if you have Tanakh and his Sefer, he has then to fill in the background to the Chanukah story, which he does. And now you know everything. When he describes the story, the Rambam says that we had the military victory. Of course, it wasn't a final victory, but it was decisive enough to get us to the Beis HaMikdash. And that victory took place on the 25th of Kislev. This, of course, resonates with the well-known explanation of the word Chanukah, Chanu Kaf Hei. They rested on the 25th. The Rambam doesn't mention that, but he does say that the war ended on the 25th. Says the Pri Chodesh, let me ask you, if the war ended on the 25th of Kislev, and then they made their way to the Beis HaMikdash to light the menorah, well, the first lighting would have been leading into the 26th of Kislev. They're in the middle of the 25th when they finished the war. So the inaugural lighting to get everything going again takes place the following evening, leading into the 26th. But if their first lighting was the 26th of Kislev, will someone please explain how our first lighting is the evening leading into the 25th? We seem to light a day before they did. That's an interesting point. And indeed, says the Pri Chodesh, that's what I'm saying. That in fact, they only began to light before the 26th. We start Chanukah a day earlier, before the 25th, because the first day is not about commemorating the lighting, it's commemorating the military victory, which took place on the 25th. What is significant is that we commemorate the military victory in exactly the same way that we commemorate the miracle of the oil, by lighting the menorah. There is no difference in the performance of the mitzvah, in the celebratory act. We light the menorah for 8 days. Why do we celebrate the battle by lighting on the menorah? Because that was their moment of victory of the battle, when they were able to light the menorah again. And that's why, even on the first day, we celebrate the battle by lighting the menorah. At any rate, says the Pri Chodesh, you can see from here that the first day is not about the miracle of the oil, because they didn't light until the 26th, but we light on the 25th. But there's a classic response to this proof of the Pri Chodesh. And that comes from a later authority, Rav Yerucham Perlman of Minsk, who was known as the Godel of Minsk. He has a commentary on the Mishnayos called Or Godel. And the Or Godel says, Pri Chodesh, not so fast. Of all the commentators from which you sought to prove your point, you chose the worst one, because your proof comes from the Rambam. But the Rambam himself is of the opinion that the menorah is not lit only at night. It is also lit during the day. And therefore, it could be that even the first day, the 25th, commemorates the oil. Did they not light? When was their first lighting? On the 25th, it was the daytime lighting, which according to the Rambam is also part of the mitzvah. So it's a classic example. You never know when the discussion ends. It seemed like the Pri Chodesh had the last say. But as is often the case, give it a couple of hundred years and someone else will have something else to say. So these are fascinating ideas that come out. Again, the Parsha is really just getting going. It's the first two psukim, and already there is so much to discuss. But of course, as we move now to the body of the Parsha and come to consider the big day Kahuna. And I wanted to talk for a few moments or have the segment of our discussion this evening in what I consider to be a particularly captivating one of the big day Kahuna. And that is the tzitz. The tzitz, we know this is the what it's called, the frontlet, which goes from on the forehead of the Kohen Gadol, and it's referred to in Pasuk Lamed Vav of Perik Kafches. It's one of the eight garments of the Kohen Gadol, one of the four special garments of the Kohen Gadol. Interestingly, what does the word tzitz mean? We've translated it functionally as frontlet, but that's not really what the word tzitz means. What does the word tzitz mean? Says the Ksav HaKabbalah, and as we know, his forte is all of the possibilities within Lashon HaKodesh. The word tzitz comes from the word lahatzitz. What does lahatzitz mean? It means to peer, to look intently at something. As we have, for example, in Shir HaShirim, mitzitz min hacharakim, to peer. Why is the tzitz? What's that got to do with peering? Says the Ksav HaKabbalah. What do you do when you peer at something? What does that look like? Actually, you narrow your focus. That is to say, your eyes close a little bit because you want to be able to see very well the thing that you're looking at. It's very interesting that peering, therefore, on the one hand, you see less, but only in order to be able to see more. As if to say, in terms of your field of vision, it's narrowed. So you're seeing less things. But the thing that you are seeing, you're seeing more. That's what it means, lahatzitz. And what that describes visually, says the Ksav HaKabbalah, is meant to happen with the Kohen Gadol experientially. As if to say, when you think about it, mentally focusing on something is the cognitive equivalent of peering, in the sense that your field of vision of your mind can have any number of things in it. But if it has too much, you're not really focusing on anything. Focus is when you narrow the field of vision so that you have one thing in mind. And you're seeing less, but what you're seeing more. The Kohen Gadol needs to be mitzitz. He needs to remove all other thoughts and all other concerns from his mind and focus on this one thing. He narrows the vision of his mind in order to intently focus on the avoda at hand. And that is why this is called the tzitz. The reminder to do so on his forehead, which he constantly is mindful of, is called a tzitz. Very, very interesting Lashon HaKodesh explanation for this entity. And what do we know about the tzitz? Let us take a look at the pasuk, Perek Kavches, pasuk Lamed Vav. Va'asisa tzitz zahav tahor. You shall make the tzitz, which as we translate as the frontlet, but that of pure gold, upitachta alav pituchei chosam, and you shall engrave on it, like a signet engraving, meaning the letters were not embedded into the tzitz, they protruded from it. The engraving took place from behind, so the letters protruded. And what do you write? Kodesh Lashem. Upitachta alav pituchei chosam Kodesh Lashem. So that's what's written. These two words were written on the tzitz, Kodesh Lashem. How were they written? The pasuk doesn't say. We can only assume they're written in a straight line. But actually, the Gemara in Masechah Sukkah says no. In Masechah Sukkah Tafhei Omid Aleph, the Gemara says that the way these two words, Kodesh Lashem, were written, is that Kodesh was written underneath and Lashem was written on top. So they were not written in a straight line. Kodesh was lower and then Lashem was higher. Why is Lashem written higher? Well, instinctively, we can understand it, that the Shem Hashem is the holiest word and therefore it should be at the highest point. But it does emerge as somewhat, one could say, unwieldy reading-wise, because no one ever reads going upwards. One wants to read in a straight line. So what are we to make of that? It seems like we've sacrificed the readability in a straight line in order to have Shem Hashem on top. Is that the case? Says the Rashash, Shmuel Strausen, one of the great commentators from Vilna in the 1800s, on the Shas, on the Gemara. No, that is not the case. We have not sacrificed any readability. How so? So in true Vilna fashion, he answers this question by posing another question. It says on the tzitz, the words on the tzitz are Kodesh Lashem. Says the Rashash, will someone please explain to me in as simple a way as possible what this is referring to? What is Kodesh Lashem? We're familiar with the words Kodesh Lashem, but what is Kodesh Lashem? Do we mean to say that the tzitz is Kodesh Lashem? But aren't all of the priestly garments Kodesh Lashem? The verse in the beginning of the parsha calls them all Big Day Kodesh. They're all Kodesh Lashem. So it seems to be lacking context, Kodesh Lashem. It's an abstract declaration. But what is it referring to? Says the Rashash, a truly wonderful idea. If you wish to understand what Kodesh Lashem is referring to, you need to remember that these words were not the only words written on the Big Day Kahuna. For alongside the tzitz, we have the Avnei Choshen and the Avnei Miluim. Avnei Shom, Avnei Miluim. What are the Avnei Miluim? On the Choshen, on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, you have each stone has the name of one of the Shvatim. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, all the way down to Yosef and Binyamin. 12 stones, one tribe on each stone. If you look at the Kohen Gadol, and you're looking for the script on the Kohen Gadol, what do you see? The names of the 12 tribes, and then on top, Kodesh Lashem. But what does it teach you? It teaches you that you know what is Kodesh Lashem? The 12 tribes of Kodesh Lashem. These words, Kodesh Lashem, this description, it's not written in the abstract. It is the end of a sentence, and the sentence begins Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, all the way through. These are Kodesh Lashem. The Jewish people are Kodesh Lashem. And now, says the Rashash, we understand why the word Lashem is on top, because the reading begins from down below. You really are reading in an upwards direction, because you start down below with the Choshen, you read the names of the tribes, and then you move upwards. And as you move upwards, you see all of these 12 are Kodesh Lashem. It's a truly amazing understanding of how the words on the tzitz correspond and correlate to the words on the Avnei Miluim. And this is what you could refer to as the essential endeavor of reading up on the Jewish people. You are literally reading up as you discover that the Jewish people are Kodesh Lashem. So says the Rashash. I believe a wonderful insight into the writing on the Tzitz. But in truth, there's more to say with reference to the names on the Miluim stone, on these 12 stones that are carried by the Kohen Gadol. We know that the Kohanim are distinct from the rest of the Jewish people. There is no question about that. They have certain areas where they go, no one else goes. There's certain things they do, no one else does. There are things that other people do that they can't do. And they are, in a sense, separate and distinct from the Jewish people. If the Kohanim as a group are distinct from the Jewish people, no one is more distinct than the Kohen Gadol. If they are distinct with a lowercase d, he is distinct with a capital D. And it's interesting, the Pasuk in Divrei HaYomim, when it talks about Aaron, it says, Vayibadel Aharon lihyos kodesh kadoshim. Aaron was separated to be kodesh kadoshim, holy of holies. And what's so interesting about that Pasuk is that we're familiar with the two locations within the Mishkan. You have the Kodesh, the sanctuary generally, and then you have the Kodesh HaKadoshim as locations, the Holy of Holies. And what the Pasuk in Divrei HaYomim is telling us is that the Jewish nation is also mapped out in that way. You have, corresponding to the area of Kodesh, of the Mishkan, you have the tribe of Kodesh, the group called the Kohanim. And corresponding to the Kodesh HaKadoshim in the Mishkan, you have the Kohen Gadol who himself, and as we know, only the Kohen Gadol can go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Each group or each representation meets its location. The Kohanim who are Kodesh can go into the Kodesh. The Kohen Gadol, Kodesh HaKadoshim, can go even into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But here we need to emphasize something which is extremely important. Distinct and detached are not the same thing. When we say that the Kohanim are distinct from the Jewish people, they are. But to say that they're detached from the Jewish people is unpardonable. Because the truth of the matter is that as much as they have their own specific duties, nevertheless, the question as to whether you are detached from the Jewish people hinges on, do you have the good of the people in mind? Do you have the good of the people at heart? You may be doing different things from them, that may well be. You may be unlike them. But if whatever you're doing is for them, you are distinct, but not detached. And what's very interesting is, and this point is made by Rav Kook Zatzal in his Chiddush Yagodas on Maseches Brachos in the seventh parak. Some people, says Rav Kook, confuse unity with homogeny, or unity with uniformity. As if to say, how can you tell that people are all as one if they're all the same? Which means if anyone would ever be different or distinct or unique, that's seen as a break from the unity of the people. But the truth of the matter, says Rav Kook, is that exactly the opposite is the case. Because if everyone was exactly the same, the whole community would disintegrate. If you could imagine that everyone in the community had the same job for the sake of unity, for the sake of uniformity. So you'd have a town of bakers, but there'd be nothing else. No one will have anywhere to live, so on and so forth. And therefore, it is specifically the uniqueness of each individual which equips him to contribute more to the community. Each one brings their unique talents, and that is how the community thrives. Which means the critical question of whether you're part of the community is not whether you're the same as everyone else, but whether what you're doing is with the community in mind. And this brings us back to the issue of the Kohanim. One of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim of our time, without doubt, Reb Shlomo Fischer, Zatzal, who passed away really just a few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, really, one could say, in a league of his own, and that, even that would be an understatement. But he makes this simple point. The Kohanim have their avoda, and no one else can do the avoda. But the most important part of their avoda is how it concludes, because it concludes with Birchas Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash. They do what they do, and only they can do it. But they do not conclude their avoda without turning around and blessing the Jewish people. And what do they mean by that? What they mean is, as much as we are distinct and we're doing things that you can't do, nevertheless, it is for the good of the Jewish people. That is what's established by concluding the avoda with Birchas Kohanim. And not only is this true for Kohanim, for Rabbi Yitzchak of Beraditchev, the Kedushas Levi, explains that it is for this reason that the Kohen Gadol has a special mitzvah wherever he goes to carry with him the names of all the 12 tribes of the Jewish people. No one is more distinct than the Kohen Gadol. No one is more separate than the Kohen Gadol. But it is that very separateness which is ultimately in order to further the cause and be a conduit for blessing for the Jewish people. He can never move without having written all over him the names of the 12 tribes of Bnei Yisrael. And through that, his distinction will never lead to detachment. That's what we see from the names of the 12 tribes on the Kohen Gadol. Interestingly, moving ahead a number of parshas on a deeper level, this is really what was behind the move of Korach. What Korach wanted officially and what he actually wanted were not the same thing at all. Officially, he champions the people. Ki kol ha'edo kulam kedoshim. And he gathers with him representatives from all the 12 tribes. That may well be. But the underlying goal of Korach has nothing to do with the 12 tribes. It's very interesting. If you look even just a simple reading of the opening sukkim of Korach, you find that Moshe does an unusual thing. When everyone approaches him and says, we all want the avoda, he responds very briefly. So if you want the avoda, come back tomorrow and try it out. It's disappointingly brief, his response to them. But then he proceeds to remonstrate with one group particularly, and that is Shevet Levi. As Moshe says, Shimuna b'nei Levi, listen to me, you sons of Levi. Is it not enough that Hashem has separated you to the extent that he has? You want to be Kohanim also? Why is he addressing the tribe of Levi when Levi has never addressed him? We're not aware that he was approached by Levi as a group. He's approached by everyone. So why is he approached by everyone? But he responds only to Levi. Because, says the Chidah, Moshe understands that ultimately his dialogue is only with the tribe of Levi. How so? What does everyone else want? Everyone wants the avoda, just like the good old days. As we know, before the sin of the Egel, any family could do the avoda, represented by their firstborn. So when they're all demanding the avoda back, what they're saying is, give us back the way things used to be. But that's an unreasonable request, because things have changed, namely in the form of the Chet HaEgel. Life has changed. You had the avoda, you lost it. And it's not a credible claim. It's not a strong claim. But there's one group within that group who has a much stronger claim. And who are they? Shevet Levi. Why? Because Levi were not involved in the Egel. They didn't do anything. They rallied around Moshe. Which means that although you could dismiss everyone else and saying things have changed because you made the Egel, but what do you say to the group who didn't make the Egel? Why have things changed for them? And Korach was a Levi. I mean, Korach had all, he had, his resume was fantastic. He was a firstborn and he was a Levi. I mean, he qualifies on all counts. Don't send me back, says Korach, or my tribe by saying things have changed since the Egel, because we weren't involved in the Egel. And that is why Moshe understands he needs to deal with the tribe of Levi, especially. What's very sinister about this is that Korach gathered all the tribes together for momentum, but ultimately he has no interest in any of the other tribes. They'll launch him, but then he'll pull away from them. And that's a very difficult thing to behold. But what is the answer? What is the answer to Levi's claim? If they didn't make the Egel, why should they suffer the new world order along with the rest of the Jewish people? The answer is very simple. Because they're part of the Jewish people. As much as they were not involved in the Egel, that may well be true. But they're part of the Jewish people. If life has changed for the Jewish people, and you maintain that it shouldn't change for you, you have detached yourself from the Jewish people. And that is not acceptable. For Korach, he's prepared to do that. Leave the other tribes behind and let Shevet Levi proceed. Why should we be held back by the rest of the people? Because you're part of the rest of the people. The very message that Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev says is etched into the stones carried by the Kohen Gadol, was abandoned by Korach. And that was unacceptable. And interestingly, before we get back to the Parshas Tetzaveh, there's a very well-known description in the Gemara, in the fifth parak of Baba Basra, Rabba Baba Chana. He was shown where Korach and his men were buried. And he's told, there's a whole episode there, and he's told to put his ear to the ground and listen carefully. And when he does, he hears them say, Moshe emes, v'terusso emes. They need to declare that Moshe is true and his Torah is true. I recall a number of years ago, one of my sons at the Shabbos table, he was 5 or 6 years old, he was curious to know who taught them the song. I don't know that they were singing necessarily, but they do say Moshe emes v'terusso emes. And this guide who showed Rabbah where they were buried says, they say this every month. And the Rashbam in his commentary explicates further, every Rosh Chodesh they say this, Moshe emes v'terusso emes. And the question, of course, is, what's Rosh Chodesh got to do with Korach? I mean, everyone else is busy saying Hallel or whatever they're saying. And this is the day where they say Moshe emes v'terusso emes. But as we know, Rosh Chodesh is the first day of the month. And the 12 months of the year correspond to the 12 tribes of Israel. Every Rosh Chodesh, and the commentators explain which month is for which each tribe, every Rosh Chodesh is a chag for one of the tribes of Israel. And that's why it's specifically on Rosh Chodesh that Korach and his men need to declare their mistake, because part of their mistake was the will to leave behind each of these 12 tribes. And therefore, it's specifically on the special day for Reuven and for Shimon, etc. and so forth, we say we made a mistake, not only about Moshe, but also about the Jewish people. There is no leaving the 12 tribes behind, because without them, there is no Jewish people. And so from no one is more distinct than the Kohen Gadol, but no one needs to have the well-being of the Jewish people at heart more than the Kohen Gadol. This teaches us that the inner meaning of community, it's not about being together with others inside a room. It's about the room that you make for others inside of you. That's what it means to be connected to community. These are the lessons that we learn from the Choshen. I'd like to conclude just for a final discussion. Take a look at the final pasuk. An anomaly within Parshas Tetzaveh is the golden Mizbeach, the Mizbeach for Ketores. There's much discussion, beginning with Rishonim. What is the Mizbeach of the Ketores doing in the end of Parshas Tetzaveh? It's a vessel of the Mishkan. It should be in Parshas Truma, along with the others. And lo and behold, it's in the end of Tetzaveh. And there's much discussion about that. We've discussed it in the past. Mirtz Hashem will do so again in the future. But in the meanwhile, the final pasuk informs us that this golden Mizbeach, although on a daily basis is used for the Ketores, it has one other function once a year. And that is on Yom Kippur, the blood of the inner sin offerings, which goes all the way in to the Kodesh HaKodoshim itself, it's sprinkled there, it's sprinkled on the paroches between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodoshim, and then it's sprinkled on the four corners of the golden Mizbeach. And that is what is described in the final pasuk, which reads, this is Perek Lamed, pasuk Yud, V'chiper Aharon al Karnosav achas bashana. Aharon will atone on the horns, the corners of the Mizbeach, once a year. Midam chatas ha-kipurim, in the blood of the sin offering of the kipurim, achas b'shana yichaper alav l'derozech. Once a year, for all generations, he will atone. That is the final pasuk of Tetzaveh. What's interesting about this pasuk, if we try and look a little carefully, or even if we're not looking that carefully, but just looking, it's stated twice. The message of the pasuk is stated twice. The first phrase says, "V'chiper Aharon al Karnosav achas b'shana." Aharon will atone on the corners of the mizbeach once a year. So now we know. The pasuk goes on to say, "Midam chatas hakipurim achas b'shana yichaper alav v'derasekim." From the blood of the Yom Kippur sin offerings, he will atone once a year. So I'm told the same thing twice, literally, one after the other. If we look a little closer, we'll see something else interesting. The two phrases, they're inverted, by which I mean. The first phrase begins with the verb, v'chiper Aharon, and then tells you the time, once a year. The second phrase is the mirror image. Once a year, he shall atone. So he shall atone once a year he shall atone. So the pasuk actually is not just doubled over, it's almost like a palindrome. So you have verb, time, verb. What are we to make of all of this? Says the Meshech Chachma. The Vilna Gaon has a well-known discussion in Parshas Acharemos, which is based on a Medrash. And the Medrash itself is quite a Chiddush, which is fine. The Medrash is entitled to say Chiddushim. The Medrash says, the Kohen Gadol can only enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim once a year. Everyone knows that. However, says the Medrash, that is only true with reference to future Kohanim Gedolim, after Aaron. But when it comes to Aaron, Aaron could enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim whenever he wanted, provided he was accompanied by the Korbanos described in Parshas Acharemos. Bekol Sha'a Sherotze Likones Yikones. Aaron can enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim whenever he wants. Uvilvad sheyikanes baseder hazeh. As long as he enters accompanied by this order of korbanos, the two goats and the whole thing. And this is an absolute revelation. Life in the time of Aaron, it could be the Yom Kippur Avoda any day of the year. And for this reason, says the Vilna Gaon, you'll notice something interesting about the opening chapter of Acharemos, what we call the laning for Yom Kippur. Every mitzvah of every Yom Tov in the Torah always follows the same pattern. The Torah gives you the date and then tells you what to do, both for mitzvahs and for korbanos. And on the first day of the seventh month, you shall do such and such. And on the 15th day of the seventh month, you shall do such and such. Amazingly, in the Yom Kippur laning, beginning of Acharemos that we know so well, there is not a mention of Yom Kippur until the very end of the chapter. It starts talking about korbanos and doesn't even tell you when it applies. The very end of the chapter, it says, and for future generations, this will be once a year. L'doro seichem. Why is it inverted? Why are we given the avoda and then only have the timestamp at the end? The answer, says the Vilna Gaon, is because for Aaron, the contents of that chapter were not limited to Yom Kippur. As the Medrash informs us, he could avail himself of this order of korbanos on any given day. And therefore, pshuto shel mikra, the simple pshat reading of the pasuk, does not restrict the message to Aaron to Yom Kippur. At the end, the chapter says, what is true for Yom Kippur any day, the Doros Seichem is once a year. And so the opening chapter of Acharemos, it had ongoing application for Aaron and once a year application for every subsequent Kohen Gadol. That's what the Parsha looks like. What does this have to do with us? Says Meshech Chochma, the very first reference we have to the Avodah of Yom Kippur is in our Parsha. It's this verse which tells us that once a year, the Mizbeach of Keturis is also used for the blood of the Yom Kippur offering. It will be a while till we get to the full Seder in Acharemos. But the first mention that Yom Kippur has unique avoda, it's right here. And now, says Meshech Chochma, have we not learned from the Medrash, as explicated by the Vilna Gaon, that the Seder of Yom Kippur existed in two capacities? For Aaron, it could take place at any time. For subsequent Kohen and Gedolim, once a year. And with all this in mind, says Meshech Chochma, let's go back to our pasuk. We noticed that the pasuk talks about this once a yearly avoda of the golden mizbeach. It talks about it twice, which was itself troubling. And then beyond that, it inverted the way that it refers to it. What's it all about? Says Meshech Chochma, a basic principle of Lashon HaKodesh is that if the verb comes first, it has potential scope beyond what is to follow. Because you mention the verb first, it is at that moment not restricted. When you later qualify it, it still then has this double identity. And what that means is, the first pasuk says v'chiper Aaron. The first phrase in the final verse says v'chiper Aaron. Why does it say Aaron? Because it's talking about Aaron, not as representing the Kohen Gadol. Aaron. Now, what's the situation with Aaron? How many times could he do this? The answer is once a year, certainly, but beyond that, optionally. And that is why v'chiper comes first, the verb comes first, because there is scope for what we're talking about beyond achas bashana. That's the first phrase, that's Aaron. And what is the second phrase? As the pasuk says, midam chatas ha-kippurim, achas bashana, yichaper alav l'doro seichem. The second phrase is l'doro seichem. That's all Kohen and Gedolim after Aaron. After Aaron, there's only one option. There's only one day, only Yom Kippur. And that's why Achas Bashana is mentioned first, as if to say it is absolutely restricted to Achas Bashana. For Aaron, there is room for V'chiper beyond Achas Bashana. But the Dero Sechem, there is only Achas Bashana, Yichaper Alav, the Dero Sechem. So from what seems to be, and we perhaps would have noticed there's a redundancy in the verse, with a bit more attention to detail, we would have seen that the terms are inverted, but where to go from there, I don't know what we would have done. I once told my Talmidim, if the person who sold the Meshech Chochmah his Chumash would have known just what the Meshech Chochmah was going to see in the Chumash, he would for sure have charged him at least double the price, because it's a different sefer. But Baruch Hashem, these are the gems to which he has treated us. And so our Parsha of Tetzaveh, it is formally within, very firmly entrenched within the Mishkan Parshas, and yet as we saw, it has emanations and implications as far back, Torah-wise, as Parshas Noach. It took us to Chanukah. We moved forward to Parshas Korach and ended up in Yom Kippur. And this is Kedarka Shel Torah, the way all things are unified. I wish you all the very best. Have a wonderful evening and a great week.